Welcome to Design Oracles. We are here to pontificate, evangelize, and educate you on residential interior design and architecture.
I'm Amity Worrell, interior designer of Amity Worrell and Company.
And I'm Diane Kett, architect of DK Studio.
Today, we're going to talk about very codes. Exciting subject. What is it, Diane?
Building codes.
Building codes.
The good and the bad.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. Okay, I'm going to just ask a quick question. One thing that always comes up with clients is why can't we break them, and where can we break them, and what parts of the country have different codes and all of that. So can you talk to us as an overview about what that whole thing is about and why they exist and all of that?
So they exist to keep us safe and so we don't die, which is good, right?
Buildings don't fall down on us.
The problem is they can sometimes be ugly and very limiting in our design, right? So it's, you know, I feel like they keep getting worse. They keep trying to make us safer and safer. You know, in the cities, counties, they adopt building codes and say what you have to follow. So there is an international building code and they update them every year, but each city adopts a certain year. So even though one came out in 2022, they might not be adopting that one. And then a lot of times other municipalities, counties, areas outside of cities, typically there are no code enforcement. You're just at the whim of hopefully your builder, contractor, the electrician, the plumber is following what the necessary codes are. And there's codes for everything. You know, like I said, plumbing and electrical, there's building codes, which is like following different distances of things.
Setbacks off the road, setbacks off the neighbor's lot. Is that what you mean?
No, those kinds of things are local ordinances and have to do per city as to what their ordinances would be for setbacks. So, and a lot of times those are set based on maybe the neighborhood design of the cities. You know, some of them may have a 25-foot front yard setback. Some may have 50. I mean, it completely varies all over the place. And so, like in the city of Austin, it's always 25 feet. But then there are some overlays in different neighborhoods in Austin that are at 30 or 40. And the city never enforces those. But you could have your local neighborhood association enforce them. So there are some in the city of Austin where they will enforce those and sue you.
So it's a very layered thing. There's the, like you say, the international codes, and then each municipality adopts different codes, and then you've got neighborhood expectations and codes, and then how does that differ from zoning? For instance, we're always hearing about, like, for instance, my studio that I work out of is zoned residential and commercial, and just to set the tone for what the difference is here. That's a zoning thing, right? Like, I could live there or work there.
Right.
I could rent it as a home or as a business.
So a city determines all the zoning. And I guess when they plan the city, they set all the zoning. Now they can rezone and change things. And you can also go to the city council and ask if you can rezone a lot. So there might be different, and it's different in every city. You have to learn what their zoning is. And so there may be different types of zoning for different size houses on different size lots. When you look at the residential zoning, there's different zoning for commercial buildings. There's zoning where you could have residential or commercial. And so a lot of times when you start working in a new city, you have to really read through all those and understand what's allowed. And sometimes within those zoning, they will then say you're allowed a 20-foot setback. You're allowed 5% impervious cover. And there's all kinds of rules and stuff.
Right.
And
so what I've noticed, I'm very impressed that you know these things, because there's a lot to know. And I've also seen a lot of very sad clients after we happy and sad when they find out what the zoning or code or whatever rules are for their particular home. But I find that, you know, it's interesting to me when I talk to you about a client who has a project, and you'll understand in depth that neighborhood even. So in this neighborhood, this is typical. Is that true? Like, there's different neighborhood, like you say, neighborhood associations, or maybe you have a better understanding in that neighborhood of the way things are built because of the ground underneath, or that's fascinating to us people who don't who are not architects. You know, there's neighborhoods that have bad soil, or so I know this is outside of the code thing, but just to set the stage, can you talk a little bit about those differences, the neighborhoods?
Yeah, so as we start designing, at least for me, all over the city of Austin, really, it's actually built, there's like a fault line that divides the city in half, and it's actually where a big interstate falls. And on one side, it's kind of more clay, black soil, they call it, and it's bad soil to build on. And so the foundations can be a lot trickier to do. It's still doable, but just can maybe cost a little more. Then on the other side, it starts to get more rocky, but then you still have pockets of clay in certain neighborhoods that then we have to do these crazy additions where we have really deep piers. But then literally across the street, you'll be on a rock ledge and, you know, you just have to go down, you know, have a regular foundation that goes down a foot or two. And whereas across the street, you're doing 30-foot deep piers and it can get kind of nutty. So, yeah. And so just from experience, we start to learn the areas and what you build on, what
got
you don't.
And
so, in fact, recently there, I was working on a house in Vermont and they had asked if we could move the building over, and we had to follow the existing footprint of the original house because of a Shoreland Protection Act, which is a local state rule. You can't build within, I think it's 125 feet of the shoreline. Well, this house is about 15 feet from the shoreline. So you couldn't move it over. But then not only that, I said, even if we could, there is a giant rock cliff that is so hard and solid. I don't even think, I mean, you would have to blast it in order to move the house over. So that's not even something you'd want to do anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I talked a little bit about geotech engineers before in the last podcast. So a lot of times they're going and doing those core samples for us on the land to tell us what kind of foundation we can have. And literally, I did have one house across the street had horrific soil, and we had to do these bell caisson crate foundation design. And on the other side, it was on a rock cliff, and we just got to do a regular old concrete foundation. So it really does vary. And so you do need to get that geotechnical report done. Then going back to the zoning and the neighborhoods, yes, so there are neighborhood overlays. And again, that varies by city. So sometimes if you're working in a neighborhood and you haven't worked in it before, we usually like to try and go research that and figure out what are the rules. A lot of times we have worked in so many different areas, we've gotten to know them all. And then there is the zoning, so we know kind of the basic zoning, but then there are some other rules that apply. So the city of Austin also has what's called the McMansion Ordinance, and that is an overlay of a certain geographical section of the city, and that has a lot of rules we have to follow that are crazy. It's a whole bunch of if-then statements. It's almost like they took geometry class to write the whole thing. And it's a really tricky to wrap your brain around. And whenever I have new architects that haven't worked with it before, I try not to have them work on any projects for a good year that are involved in the McMansion, because it's so tricky and difficult to navigate your way through. Now you go outside of the city, and like I said, they don't have codes. And so another thing is the fire code as well. That will also tend to vary by jurisdictions, counties, cities. And so also another thing is maybe they say, okay, we're adopting the 2020 IRC, but we have these other conditions that you have to follow. So like the city might write other things they want you to follow. And a lot of times the fire marshal gets involved with that, and they usually want to do some other type of things you have to follow for the code.
So where it comes up for where I hear it coming up is when I'm working with a client and they start asking for something outside the envelope of their house, and I start talking about, well, we're going to need an architect for that. And, you know, not everything is, you know, there's codes we have to follow, obviously, too, but those are more related to interiors, like spacing for toilets and plumbing walls and anyway, those things, which I know you're going to talk about. But I always tell them, you know, even if you're, then they say, yay, I'm in an area where we don't have to follow the codes. There's nobody going to come out and check. There's not an inspector. You still want just public service announcement here. You still want your builder to understand the codes that for safety, especially, and to, for the most part, especially for plumbing, electrical, to follow those codes. There's really good reason for a lot of
them. And a lot of times, really good builders will say, I'm putting in money for a third-party inspector who's going to come, and there's companies you can hire that will come and inspect your plumbing, your electrical, all the stuff that the city would inspect if you were within the city. Now, sometimes there's some rules, like I'll give you an example where the sink, the center of the sink has to be 15 inches off the edge of the wall. Well, let's say you're in a powder room and you only have 24 inches of space to put your tiny little hand washing sink in. Well, you're not going to meet that code. But let's say we're outside of the city. Is that something that's really detrimental and going to cause harm? Probably not.
It might splash the wall.
Yeah. And Amity has selected some gorgeous tile surround for that. So
there's a fix for that.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's where then you could say, well, they may have said that we're not following the code, but I think it's okay to not follow the code.
Right. So it's like one of those things where you want to know, you can break the rule if you know the rule and you discuss what the implications of breaking that rule.
And a lot of times we always bring it up with the homeowner. Look, this is the code. This is how we're breaking it. Are you okay with that? You know, if it's not a life and safety issue, that's when I always feel like, okay, I think that in this situation it could be okay.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. And so for the interior piece of it, the other one that comes up a lot is just, you know, we've got a limited amount of space and people want to move the toilet. And there's all these rules about the width of the room for a toilet room, or it's like 30 inches, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 30 inches mm-hmm. by 4'6". I know you always do it in all inches. I do it in feet and inches. But yeah, so 30 inches wide, which typically we always design 32 because you usually draw a house that doesn't, when you're drawing a new house, it doesn't include the jib board. So we usually draw it at 32. So then we allow for that wiggle room of the jib board to go in.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize that. And then I'm interested too, as on the interior side, about the, there may be not even codes really, but in the kitchen, obviously, the widths and spacing for everything. What are the codes in kitchens that we would need to know?
Mostly the codes in kitchens have to do with electrical.
Oh, okay. Like for safety.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, which is things we run up against in design a lot. Mm-hmm. So we have to now, and again, it varies by city. So in the city of Austin, we have this code where you have to have an outlet within 2 feet of the center line of a kitchen sink. I've always tried to understand why. And so the idea is so you're not plugging something into an outlet and running the cord across and over the sink.
Right. They're trying to manage our behavior by saying, if we give you this outlet here, you're not going to electrocute yourself by running the cord under the faucet. So they're setting you up for a win. So that's good. Mm-hmm. Sure messes with our backsplash a lot of times.
Or if we have windows that go to the sill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you also have a dishwasher next to your sink generally, which is 24 inches.
Yeah.
So.
So you're saying they're breaking their own rule there?
So it's really hard if you can't put it in the wall.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that definitely comes up and we end up doing plug strips, but you still need switches.
Or there's pop-up. Pop-up
outlets.
So there
are tricks for these things, but this is why it's so important to work with when you're, you know, choosing someone with a lot of experience and experience with codes and experience with layouts and mechanicals and safety rules so that you can plan for those things. So you don't lose, you don't discover that your $55 square foot tile that you've already purchased and is sitting in the garage and about to be installed has to have a big fat white duplex outlet cut into it. We've planned for that. So I think the intricacies sometimes are lost on people, but that is why the value of the experience of working with someone who really knows what they're doing is
And it's interesting because in like San Antonio, They don't read it like that strictly. It's more 2 feet off the edge of the sink.
Yep.
So it's, again, it kind of varies by city and also their interpretation of it and what they choose to enforce.
And I would say, whether this is like something I should say out loud, it varies too by the inspector that arrives sometimes in the field.
Yeah.
So I've had experiences where we'll have an inspector come in And who there's already been one there that's approved everything. And then maybe they did, there's a framing inspection. And then when does electrical happen?
Electrical is the first rough inspection that you do.
But framing too is before, isn't that before
no,
that?
No, it's after.
Okay. Never mind. So maybe it's the electricals come in.
We will have the structural engineer come in and do a framing inspection. But as far as the city looking at it, that usually happens later. Although,
yes, so.
Again, it could be different city by city.
Well, I just find that sometimes maybe there's an inspector in a bad mood or they come in to inspect something and maybe they don't like the way that the job site's being kept or they don't like this builder for whatever
or
reason.
They didn't like something you did previously.
Or there's a fender bender out front. Who knows what causes the – but
– and then also there's inspectors that have certain tolerances, like they allow so much off of whatever the – code says.
Yeah, so sometimes we'll have an experience where one inspector will come in and say, this is wrong, all these things have to be moved and changed. And then another inspector will come when maybe half of that has been moved and changed and say, oh no, okay, now you're good. And so there's, you know, these are human beings. They have moods and they have personal tolerances too. Mm-hmm. And there's room for interpretation with some of these things. So anyway, just something to keep in mind that I always think is another reason that you have to build good relationships in cities. And then, you know, we didn't talk about this before, but one of the experts that Diane needs to bring in is besides the engineer structural people, is the fellow who helps with getting the permits. Sorry,
Expediter.
The permit expediter.
I do have a good relationship with permit expediters.
And then,
if the builder doesn't do it. Sometimes there's builders that like to do it all, and that's fine too. But we don't actually go take the permit stuff down to the city. We usually hire what's called a permit expediter. Now, because that word expediter is in there, that doesn't mean that it's going to happen faster.
Yeah.
Maybe it does because they actually know the people to go talk to when some problems come up. But yeah.
I also find, and this is true, that the city of Austin, at least, will prioritize a project that has an architect stamp on it, that so it moves through the process quicker. Isn't that true, Diane? Is that an official rule?
But I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
Because I don't have anything to compare it to. You might.
That's true. Yeah, we find we are told sometimes by builders that if we get an architect's sign off on things, and we don't typically have to do it unless it's an addition if we're going outside the envelope of the house, and just depending on what type of permit we're looking for, it can move quicker if it's got an architect stamp on it. So sometimes that's just having an architect review it, I think, and stamp it. But anyway, just something to note.
So going back to the kitchen, another tricky thing, and you probably run into this a lot too, is the outlets on the island because they have to be within 6 feet. So a lot of times we have one on both sides. They also don't seem to let you count putting it underneath because then the cord could cause a hazard and someone could accidentally grab the cord and then something goes flying and electrocutes you or chops you up or something, you know.
So then we have the challenge of hiding that electrical outlet.
Hide
the exposed outlet on the side of the island by maybe we do a wooden stained covered outlet if the island is a stained wood.
A lot of times we're doing things like that.
Or maybe it's beautiful brass and we'll do a brass and we'll highlight it in the plumbing and lighting fixtures or brass in there. But it's always a conversation. It's not to be avoided. You can't think it's just going to take care of itself. Mm-hmm. I've been through too many job sites where I walk through and say, okay, if every outlet you've just put in has to be changed because the paint is going to be dark in this location. We can't have big pops of white. You need to change them all to black. Or I have a beautiful rich brown, or I have stained in my house, and then some areas I have white. So these things don't just take care of themselves. And then, of course, not to get too far into the decorating piece of it, but there's different colors of white for these outlets.
Yes.
So there's a lot to know. And if you don't have the experience, you might not get ahead of that. And then it'll cost the clients time and money to get it corrected, or it just their value of the experience can save them money and time in that way.
Right. And then there's a lot of codes with stairs.
Yeah,
I always think it's funny that people think stairs don't take up that much space in a house. But when you have to follow all the codes with the tread, with the height of the riser, the way the railing has to be done.
7-12, right? 7 for the height?
12 no, for it's the, 7 okay, and it 3 quarters for the height, and it's 11 inches.
Okay, so I was close. 7, yeah. 12, 7, 12. Okay. Yeah.
In commercial, it's different as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so in residential, we have a lot to figure out with that. And that's where we really get into a lot of math as architects, trying to figure out how we can fit the stairs in and what that distance is going to be. Landings also can't be more than 36 inches, but if they're in the path of travel, they have to be the same width as the path of travel. So there's all kinds of things. And then
handrails.
These circular stairs are really tricky too.
And then the handrails. We were just having a meeting about that yesterday. And
so you have to have a certain clearance between that's completely clear.
Left to right.
Mm-hmm. Right. But then you also have mm-hmm. to have one continuous handrail.
Right. So you can switch. You can be going up the stairs and have a handrail on your left. And then when that hits a wall or breaks.
If you're at a landing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're at a landing, you have to have a handrail on the right so that you can immediately sort of switch hands and
yeah, it's really tricky when we go lay all that out. We're thinking, okay, this one can go continuous. Oh, wait, we just bumped into the ceiling. Or, okay, let's go on this side. Or you have those winder stairs. And so there's a lot of tricks. And a lot of times I'll say to the builder, the next time you see the inspector, can you talk to them about what they will allow and not allow? Because, again, that can also be, especially on the winder stairs, really tricky as to how that is met, because there's also a certain height it has to be from the stair, which is 36 inches.
Which brings
or
up
– within – it's I think it's 32 to 38.
There's two things that brings up in my mind about rules and breaking them, which is the rule about the height for sconces on stairs, lighting
stairs. Uh-huh.
Boy, that one annoys me because it's so much higher than I want to put my beautiful sconce. I want to be able to really see it. And I think it's like 80 inches or something above the floor, above the finished floor.
Yeah, and that can be tricky based on where the step is.
It can be tricky. Mm-hmm. And so you get this really mishmashy looking stair if you're not careful. So you have to choose the light fixture accordingly. Mm-hmm. If you choose a light fixture that's really long, for instance, and then you have to so that it, you know, kind of like covers the whole wall and gives an expanse of light top to bottom, and then you have to put it 80 inches above your head so you really only can appreciate it from the second story, then it doesn't look great. So maybe you want something really tight to the wall and small that sends light up and down. Mm-hmm. And so these are all decisions, knowing those codes that we make when we're making selections for a client. We keep those rules in mind. And I find that we're constantly reminding clients about that. So we'll get into a meeting. We're doing the electrical. We've done selections. We're working off the architect's plans. And, you know, there's a question, and I'd love to know, Diane, if you want to talk about this, but the clients really want can lights in closets, but we need.
Yeah, you're not allowed to because some reason they think you might hit that light bulb and explode and I guess burn up on fire or something. So again, it's protecting us.
Yeah.
So it usually has to have a cover. So sometimes they allow almost like that shower and cover that you have in a shower for a can light.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes it's just some type of flush mount.
It
definitely has to be a covered bulb.
Yeah. So that ends up being frustrating for people because, first of all, they have to buy more lights. Mm-hmm. We have to choose it. They have to purchase it. And then they don't like the look of the closet light, and neither do I.
Right.
But that's the one that's going to give the most light. And so there's always a discussion about that. And then the over the tub.
Can't be less than 8 feet because you might slip and grab the chandelier.
Electrocute yourself. Yeah. So Diane and I have, I think, even yelled at one another on a job site a couple times where I really want the chandelier and the client. And then the ceiling's too low and we can't raise the ceiling or it's already built. So I lost that last one. But yeah. And then I just want to mention, we brought up stairs and we were working on stairs yesterday, that I think the importance of the stair tread and tread depth and riser height for stairs is so important for not tripping. And I think many of us have probably been on those historic home tours and trying to go up a flight of stairs where they haven't followed a code. And maybe you trip every third step. There's just a natural kind of ergonomic flow, the cadence of stepping. So, you know, there's a particular a drop that's a little bit heavier, maybe it's only 3/4 of an inch different than the other steps, it can mean a serious
tumble. You just really
tumble.
Notice it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It can mean a serious. So these things are, they feel minor, but they're really add up and they can be major. And so, you know, you don't even notice what these codes have done for you, but I want to promote that they do help. They create
and usually
safety.
The top step and the bottom step are allowed. I can't remember what the tolerance is, because sometimes those end up a little bit different than the other risers because of the other floor treatments at the bottom and top.
Sometimes
there's a little bit of give. It's definitely less than an inch. I might want to say it's a half inch, but I can't remember exactly.
That has to do with, and I'm fascinated by this, but that has to do with sort of when you are first arriving at a stair, your mind goes, oh, I'm at a stair. There's a handrail here. I'm at a stair. And you naturally will step higher. But then once you get going, like Diane was saying, the cadence becomes regular. And then maybe when you arrive at the top, you know, you've all seen those stairs where people put tape or paint yellow or something to indicate where a stair is. Otherwise, you know, you're going to miss your step. So I'm always interested in and frustrated by garages and that tire bump.
You
don't have to have that.
Mm-mm.
But it's for safety, right? So if you had a little too much to drink and you're pulling the car into the garage.
I think that's worse because you're going to trip on it when you go to walk
that's
out.
That's a good point.
We actually don't really put those in unless people request them these days.
Interesting. They used to be a thing then, I guess.
Yeah, they were. Mm-hmm.
But I know that when we've tried to expand a laundry room or expand mm-hmm. out and then we run into that different floor height, it can be frustrating.
Yeah. Oh, also on stairs, there's the stair railing, what we call the baby head rule. So you have to design so there isn't a space larger than a 4-inch sphere could fit through. And that can get pretty tricky to work out. And especially when a lot of times people come and they show us these beautiful images of stair railings and we got to try and figure out how to make it look like that but still meet code. And it can be tricky. And now that's another thing where outside of the city limits or jurisdictions enforcing codes, that's another time where sometimes we might have a little bit of wiggle room there.
Yeah, that's one of those things that is always tricky, though, because I had a client who wanted that, and they said, my kid's not going to stick their head through this passage. But I said, well, are they going to have play dates?
Yeah.
Because somebody else's kid might stick their head through it. And so there's liability reasons. You know, I think we've talked about this on podcast before, but Diane and I had a client who had a historic home and the stair rail height was too low.
Yeah, there's right.
So then, so that nobody would take a tumble, we had to take the stair.
Mm-hmm. Kind of took it apart and
rebuilt it. Rebuilt it and put the historic part of it back on different plinths mm-hmm. so that we gained the height back that we needed for code. And, you know, we as expert professionals would have wanted to do that regardless of whether or not the client said, look, I don't have kids, I don't care about, you know, we would have wanted to do that for our own being able to sleep at night. We care a lot about the safety of our clients and
right. Yeah. So there's also, I don't know if you want to talk about all, there's bathroom codes, there's window codes.
Go for it.
I mean, bathroom codes, we talked a little bit about the toilet size. Now that is like the minimum. And honestly, 4'6" is that. So basically that's the wall opposite the wall behind the toilet. So basically if you're trying to design a smallish bathroom, that's your limit to that 4'6". You can't go 4 feet. Now, you've probably been in homes where it was 4 feet. They used to do that back. I just was in a house in the 50s, and they wanted to add a shower on the other side of the toilet. And I said, but I don't even think you're going to be able to get in there because it's so small. That's kind of the smallest. And it's actually a little tricky to get a door into that. So you usually end up with a tiny door. So a lot of times then they come a little bit bigger. Then there's the sink roll with the 15 inches. And then shower clearance, you can't have a shower less than 30 inches wide. So that's also something to think about. So then if you have the tile adding on, you want to design it to be 2'8" usually to allow for all of that tolerance that might happen. There's another tricky one with switches in bathrooms. You can't have it within 3 feet of a bathtub or shower. And when you have these tiny rooms and you have pocket doors and you have, it can get really challenging to figure out where to put the switch.
Yeah. We have to stand there and kind of noodle on it sometimes in the field. We'll put it in the drawing and then everything gets built out and we make a site visit and we have to move it. Or, you know, these are all, they seem like small things, but they're big things. And then we get shut down if we don't do that. So it's very important to think about.
And those are ones that we usually do try to always follow. Because you could probably electrocute yourself.
Yeah, that small thing.
We don't really want that.
No.
Then on windows and also in bathrooms, you have to make sure they're tempered. So a lot of times when we're reviewing window orders way before, you know, sticks are going up, we're making sure that those windows in the bathrooms are tempered because occasionally we have had them where they didn't get caught that they were tempered. Sometimes the builder doesn't catch it. Sometimes the builder assumes the window vendor is catching it. Sometimes the window vendor does catch it, but we are always checking that because otherwise that won't get caught until the very end when you're trying to move in your house and they say, well, you have to replace this whole window. The glass is not tempered. Mm-hmm. So there's those things. Also, windows next to doors have to be tempered.
So that when you decide you want to slam open the door, swing open the door, if it hits the wall, it can't.
Or I guess completely miss the door and run through the window.
Yeah, either one. I was with a client the other day. We were checking out decorative glass and for a shower, and every decorative glass that the client liked doesn't come tempered because they have to heat it up. And these particular glass were seedy, had seeds in it, so there's air pockets in the glass. And they were very frustrated because we couldn't choose any of the decorative glass they wanted because of the function of the door.
Right.
So that's a very important thing to know. We ended up taking with us the samples of the only ones we were allowed to choose from so we wouldn't be sad anymore about having to not use the fancier glass.
Yeah. So windows, there's also fire egress. You have to have a window in every bedroom that's operable. Now, if you had sliding glass doors or a door out to a balcony, that counts. But you basically have to have an opening of 5.7 square feet. That typically equates to a 3-foot wide window that's 5 feet tall that's a double hung. Or you can go to like a 24-inch wide window that is like 3 feet high for a casement. However you have to do, there are inspectors that will go and do that measurement. Inside it has to be no more than 20 inches, and it varies by window manufacturer. It could actually be 19 3/4, and they'll make you change that window. I've had that happen.
Oh.
So there is all that kind of stuff you have
and
to check.
And stool height, too, inside the house.
Yeah, it can't be higher than 44 inches.
So when we did the renovation on my 1971 house, I didn't want to change the opening sizes of the windows, but they were not to current code. And I do have children. I'd like them to be able to climb out the window if there was ever a fire. And so we had to lower the stools or the sills, whatever.
That happens a lot in those age houses.
Yeah. And
we
so
have a house right
in
now
one
like
room,
that.
There's a window that starts at a lower point.
Mm-hmm.
I was fine with that. I didn't want to pay for another window. But those are important. The fire safety is very important.
There's also visitability codes. Now, those typically aren't in those international residential codes, and they're written separately. And more cities are adopting these. Now, the state of California created one a few years ago. Theirs is probably the strictest. But the idea of them is that if you are injured, you can easily get in and out of your house and move around. It isn't necessarily that anyone with a wheelchair could move into this house. It's not, you're not designing exactly for that, but it's the idea to have that visibility. So a lot of times it has to do with having one door that has like a zero threshold. So a lot of times in the garage, we do that. So then you come in the garage and it's a zero threshold into your house. The idea, if you have a walker, wheelchair, or whatever, you're not having to get up over a step. Then typically in the bathroom, you have to put blocking in for future handrails.
Mm-hmm.
So not that you have to put handrails in, but in the future. And then also a door size, whether it's 3 foot or 2'8". In the city of Austin, it's 2'8". So they want to get the bathroom prepared for you if that were the case.
They're planning on your behalf.
And then also they want to make sure that there's certain width that you can get around to the kitchen and everything. So.
Yeah, and we've had clients who have medical issues and mobility issues where it's an issue even if they're not injured or it's just a life thing. So a lot more and more we're making sure that we have blocking in the wall no matter what. So, and we just will typically do one whole wall instead of waiting to find out where exactly we might want to place mm-hmm. a handrail, because that can vary based on the mobility issue that a person is having. We just block out the whole wall, which costs a little bit more, but saves you in the end to be able to put the handrail wherever you want it.
Yeah, there's also the aging in place we sometimes do with clients that they don't need it now, but maybe in the future. So we just think about the door sizes and putting blocking in for future handrail, grab bars, and things like that. See, what else do you want me to talk about?
Well, let's see. What's your least favorite code?
My least? There are so many.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, the landing outside a door can be really tricky, especially if you have to step down into a garage.
Are you bringing up my back door again? Is that what you're trying to do?
I don't remember your back door having
at my studio. I don't have a landing. Yes. It actually is quite dangerous. I almost fall every day.
Well, so it's typically more if there's – yours has a number of steps. But if it's just got one or two steps, I do find it to be a little bit ridiculous. And sometimes people have lived with that for years and years in their house because it used to be code. Mm-hmm. It used to be current. And now you have to have this big landing. And so it can really affect getting your car and getting in and out. And it can be really tricky. But when we design new houses, we easily design for that. It's more the retrofit that is – where we struggle a lot.
So I think the important thing to know is that when you're choosing your expert professionals to work on a project, you want to make sure that they have an understanding of the codes and the rules and the guidelines. And if you're going to break a rule, you need to have that conversation. And we always want to keep everybody safe and still make the space beautiful. So that just takes some planning.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
All right.
Well, that's us pontificating on codes for today.
Thanks for
listening.
Hopefully
you learned a few things and you'll know why we can't do some things.
Yep. Thanks, Diane. We'll see you next time.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Design Oracles with Amity Worrell, owner of Amity Worrell & Company, and Diane Kett, owner of DK Studio.